Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to class number 40 of Exploring the Lord of the Rings. As we are now 40 classes and the better part of a year into this little endeavor. And we're in the Barrow Downs. In fact, we are going to begin inside the Barrow here tonight, which is exciting. And we're going to get some Barrow White poetry, which is really fun. So, with all of these things to look forward to, I am eager to jump straight in tonight. But I do have one important announcement, just to make sure that everybody is on board with the exciting thing that's happening this week, because this week is the beginning of our next class, our next book in the Mythgard Academy series. We are, in fact, starting Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams tomorrow night. I'm all ready. I've got my towel, right? I got my peanuts, beers in the fridge. It's all ready to go. So we're going to be great for tomorrow night. I know where my towel is, and I'm excited. So we're going to talk about the first, I think, three chapters of the book, right up through the destruction of the Earth. So that's going to be pretty awesome. So, spoiler alert. Yeah, I know. Sorry. I apologize for that. Anyway, so I'm excited. It's going to be a much shorter class, of course, because it's a much shorter book than, say, The Treason of Isengard. But I'm looking to do, I'm planning to do 5 class sessions on the book. And then we're gonna do a class session after that on the original radio broadcast, the BBC radio broadcast, which of course came first. This actually I only learned fairly recently. I'd always just kind of read the book and I didn't know much about it. But of course, the BBC broadcast came first, and the book was based on that. So I want to go back and look at the radio broadcast as well, which is really interesting. Anyway, and thank you, those of you who are calling me a hoopy fruit. I appreciate that. That's gonna be a lot of fun. So I hope you'll be able to join me. It's tomorrow. If you go to mythgard.org, you'll find the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy page there under the Mythgard Academy tab. And that will give you everything that you need to know, the reading assignments and the link to join us and everything. So it's going to be great. Anyway, I hope that you will be able to join us. You can also join us right here on Twitch. We'll be simulcasting on Twitch. So if all else fails, don't worry about it. Just come to twitch.tv/signumu and you'll see it. I'm simulcasting all of my classes here on Twitch. So again, all you have to do, subscribe to our Twitch channel and you'll never miss any of the things that I do. Even when, for instance, I do a completely surprise stream even to myself. I would have caught like the latest of the like horrid bugs that my family brings home to me this past weekend. So I was rather under the weather, but you know, it's my kids, right? So when my son comes to me and says, "Can we please do another stream talking about the Silmarillion?" I'm like, "Well, okay." Like, I'm dragging myself out of my sick bed and doing a spontaneous stream on Sunday afternoon, which is what I did. And that's been really great for those of you who have who didn't know about these. My 9-year-old son Matthias and I are doing a combined stream where we're doing analysis and discussion of Blind Guardian's Nightfall and Middle Earth album. We're going through, in my traditional fashion. We did a song and a half, actually, on Sunday afternoon, which was really pretty good progress. It was pretty awesome. Matthias was killing it. He had a bunch of really good observations that I didn't see. So it was really neat. Anyway, I hope, you know, just again, how you can arrange to not miss those things live, just subscribe to our Twitch channel and you'll get a notification when those things happen. So anyway, all right. Thanks, Lady Shmevulak approves of my son's name. Yeah, Matthias is a really fun name. I was really happy with that one. To be honest, the one of the main reasons we named him Matthias is that I wanted to, we kind of wanted to give him an unusual name, but I wanted an unusual name with an escape clause, right? So if he didn't want to have an unusual name, if he turned out to be like really shy and didn't want to be different, then, you know, he could still just be Matt if he wanted to, you know, if he wanted to fit in, or he could have a cool, an unusual name. But I've always loved the name Matthias. So anyway, it's worked out really well. And he's always very amused when our friend and frequent attendee, not so much in these evening sessions for obvious reasons, Matthias from Sweden attends. And so, you know, he's to see the guy from Sweden who shares his name. So, yeah. Nat Vilkius, I know, right? Like, it is the name of one of the apostles, like the 13th apostle, granted. And I will admit, it is Acts chapter 1 and not Redwall that I was thinking of when I named him originally. But, you know, Redwall was just kind of a bonus, actually. Anyway, so cool. So let us begin. Let's jump straight into the Barrow here. Remember that last week, one of the things that I was emphasizing is really what I was kind of trying to set up, right, was what I want to look at today, which is, where is the struggle? This is a scene, right? Frodo and the Barrow, which, I mean, this is a pivotal moment, right? Gandalf is later going to call this moment that we're looking at here tonight as possibly the most dangerous moment of Frodo's entire trip, right? So from when they leave, well, I was going to say Buckland, really, when they leave Bag End, all the way until when they get to Rivendell, so including, you know, the Ford of Bruinen, including the Dell under Weathertop, Gandalf says that this moment might have been the most dangerous of all. So wherein lies the struggle? You know, what we're not going to get is a whole lot of action, right? How is it that Frodo fights? Because he does fight the White, right? This is a struggle between Frodo and the White, and I want to watch. I want to watch how this goes. So, all right, let us go in. And I have no notes and queries tonight; just straight into the text. My sort of joking title is "More Hospitality." We talked a lot about the hospitality of Tom Bombadil, of course, for the Hobbits, and tonight we're going to see the more unusual hospitality of the Barrow White, but it's still a form, a kind of form, a twisted form of hospitality. So anyway, I see you guys all teasing me about saying that you fight the White. JJ wants you to fight the White at night, but that's not all right, actually, JJ, because it's really, and you certainly don't want to fight them on the east side, which of course is what Frodo ends up doing. Okay, so let's look at Frodo waking up inside the Barrow. When he came to himself again, for a moment he could recall nothing except a sense of dread. Then suddenly he knew that he was imprisoned, caught hopelessly. He was in a Barrow. A Barrow White had taken him, and he was probably already under the dreadful spells of the Barrow Whites, about which whispered tales spoke. He dared not move, but lay as he found himself, flat on his back upon a cold stone, with his hands on his breast. Okay, now let's just pause there for a second. Look at that first paragraph. First of all, I don't know what the whispered tales are, and I kind of wish I did, right? What are the dreadful spells of the Barrow Whites? So notice, for one thing, right? The fear of the Barrow Whites, the danger that he's in from the Barrow Whites, sometimes people will talk about the Barrow Whites as if, you know, it's like a zombie thing, right? Or like an undead thing. I mean, I've talked about the Barrow Whites, you know, a bunch of times in association with like Halloween broadcasts and stuff like that. But if you think about the kinds of, probably the two most popular, you know, undead motifs in the modern world are zombies and vampires, right? We get a lot of zombies and vampires in our culture, and both of them are interesting in different ways, right? And they seem to both be kind of associated with different fears and anxieties and different sort of cultural interests and taboos and things like that. The Barrow White is neither one of those things, right? is certainly not, he's certainly not like a zombie, right? The danger that Frodo having been taken by the undead, he's not worried he's just going to get his brains eaten or something like that, right? That's obviously totally not the issue, right? So what is the issue? The issue is that are the dreadful spells that the Barrowites are going to... They're not going to kill him exactly. At least that's not like what he's thinking. Okay, he's not worrying about being brutally and horribly killed. He's worried about the dreadful spells that they're going to... that they're going to lay him under here. So... what are the dreadful spells about which whispered tales spoke? I agree that... I assume, Natvilkius, that these are dreadful spells that the Whites themselves inflict upon others, that they... under which they place, like, through which they do... I don't even know what, right? Because I even heard the whispers myself, right? And I assume it's not dreadful news about the Whites, though that is a possible interpretation of that. Because it's tales speaking about the spells. So I assume that those are spells like incantations, like enchantments. Yes, JJ, he is worried about a fate worse than death. Yeah, exactly. Are they spells of possession? Possibly? Domination? Like to have your will and spirit dominated by the Barrowites? I don't know, but look what cues we get. We're told, first of all, the stories about the dreadful spells of the Barrowites are so terrible that people only whisper them. Right, they don't even want to speak them aloud. So the tales themselves are clearly very dreadful. But look at the immediate cue that we get, namely Frodo's own posture. Right, he dared not move, but lay as he found himself, flat on his back upon a cold stone, with his hands on his breast. Frodo has not been killed. Right, the Barrowite has taken him. But he hasn't ripped him up. He hasn't eaten his brains. What the Barrowite has done is laid him out as if he were already dead. Right? He is lying on a stone bier inside a barrow. Notice that he was in a barrow. Right? That's Frodo's first realization. And, you know, something that I think... And this is such an obvious observation that it might seem that it doesn't actually need to be said, but I think it does, because I know that I, for one, often forget it. That is to say, forget, because the word barrow doesn't replace the word barrow with the word tomb, for instance, right? He was in a tomb. He wakes up and finds himself lying on a stone bier in a tomb with his hands folded on his chest, right? A barrow is a burying place. Yes, it's a scary place where the undead live, and again, that's I think the reason why the barrow doesn't hit me quite as hard, because when I kind of put myself into Frodo's place, the fear that I feel is like the fear of the creepy undead creatures, not the fear of like I've been buried alive. Right. I've been buried alive and left for dead. But that's clearly a pretty major issue for Frodo. Right. He was in a barrow. A Barrowite had taken him. Exactly, Hrothgar. He's in the posture of a corpse. He's not dead, but it is as if he's dead. Let's keep going. But though his fear was so great that it seemed to be a part of the very darkness that was round him, he found himself as he lay, thinking about Bilbo Baggins and his stories, of their jogging along together in the lanes of the Shire and talking about roads and adventures. There is a seed of courage hidden, often deeply, it's true, in the heart of the fattest and most timid hobbit, waiting for some final and desperate danger to make it grow. Frodo was neither very fat nor very timid. Indeed, though he did not know it, Bilbo and Gandalf had thought him the best hobbit in the Shire. He thought he had come to the end of his adventure, and a terrible end. But the thought heartened him. He found himself stiffening, as if for a final spring. He no longer felt limp like a helpless prey. No longer felt limp like a helpless prey. No longer felt that way suggests that he did feel that way before, right? That made a part of that initial feeling that he had when he woke up. He was in a barrow. A Barrow-wight had taken him, and he was probably already under the dreadful spells of the Barrow-wights, right? There's that kind of fatalism. Like, it's already done. I'm over. There's no way I can get out of this. The hopelessness, the despair, which led to him feeling limp like a helpless prey, right? But he no longer feels like that. Look at the first sentence of this second paragraph. Though his fear was so great that it seemed to be a part of the very darkness that was round him, right? I think it is a part of the darkness that is round him. In fact, I think that the fear that he is under is the dreadful spell of the Barrow-wight, right? Or at least it's a part of the dreadful spells of the Barrow-wight. That fear, that lying there limp like a helpless prey, already laid out in his funeral, right after his funeral. He's already buried and laid out. He's just not been killed yet, right? And that sense, the horror of that, the paralyzing fear of that, the despair that leads to, I've already lost, right? I am in the midst of being destroyed. And I've heard rumors about the Barrow-wights and whatever absolutely horrible thing they're going to do, they're already doing to me, right? I think I'm probably already under their spells, right? That is the attack of the Barrow-wights. That is the significance, I think, of the attack that he's on. That is the spell that he's under, and he's fighting it. And how does he fight it? He fights it by remembering Bilbo and Bilbo's stories and of their adventures together in the Shire, talking about the roads and talking about adventures. I don't know exactly how you measure that. Somebody was just asking this. How do you measure the best hobbit in the Shire, right? In context, the measuring stick that seems to be being used here, or rather the quality that is being assessed and on which Frodo is being praised so lavishly here by the narrator, is timidity, essentially, courage and timidity, that he is not very timid. Even the most timid hobbit has a seed of courage that's in his heart that can still grow and will grow under extreme circumstances. Frodo is apparently not. Tom, I suppose that the hobbit who makes the best fish and chips is probably also in the running for best hobbit in the Shire. But that doesn't seem to be the context of the remark right here. Corey, I think that he is fighting it by remembering the Shire. So just asking, is he fighting it by remembering the Shire? Does that just come up, you know, sort of by chance as he's lying there? No, I think that's fighting it. Notice the structure of that first sentence. Though his fear was so great, right? Despite the greatness of his fear, which is like surrounding him like the darkness, which again, I think it is. I think that fear is coming from outside, right? From the darkness of the barrow itself, right? Though his fear was so great, he found himself thinking about Bilbo Baggins and his stories. So the fact that he is thinking about Bilbo Baggins and Bilbo's stories, despite his fear, that's a good thing. That's a sign of his lack of timidity, right? That's a sign of his courage. That's a sign of his character, what makes him the best hobbit in the Shire. And again, then in that last sentence, we get a further explanation of it, right? He thought he had come to the end of his adventures. He thinks he's done, right? He doesn't have hope, exactly. He's not being optimistic here. He doesn't think he can get out of it. He is pretty sure he's going to die. He might already be dead, or, you know, like, fatally wounded, or, like, terminally ensorcelled, or whatever has happened to him. He doesn't even know what's happened to him, right? He thinks he's come to the end of his adventures, and that it's a horrible end, a terrible end that he's come to. But what's his reaction to that? His reaction is hardness, right? The despair that he feels does not make him a helpless prey to the fear. It hardens him against it. That's the good reaction, right? That's the strong reaction. Of course, you may, remembering that hardening, right? We're going to see that, of course, very prominently with Sam and Mordor. If you remember Sam and Mordor and the hardening process that goes on with him. And when does it happen? When is he most hardened? He's most hardened when he feels most despairing, that is most certain that they're going to die and they can't make it back, right? That's when his will hardens in this same way. So Frodo here, so we're seeing the struggle happening, right? The white is on offense with his fear and despair, his desire to make Frodo into a helpless prey, right? Frodo's refusal to be a helpless prey and instead having his courage harden and him, even his body stiffening as if ready for action, right? That response is his counter to the spell, to the dreadful spell of the Barrow White. Yeah, and Matt, that's a great point. Matt is pointing out a nice parallel from this shift from timidity to courage in the darkness in the moment before Bilbo leaps over Gollum. And Matt, that's a really interesting one, right? Because on a physical level, it's reversed. That is, I agree that sort of morally, spiritually, there's a parallel there, right? But physically, while he's feeling helpless and desperate, Bilbo, I mean, right? He's like ready for action, right? He's going to kill it, stab its eyes out, right? He's ready to attack Gollum. And when his pity emerges and his resolve hardens, he lets down that, right? He eases off the desperate action desire. Right, so it's kind of interesting how we get that reversal with Frodo, and obviously their situations are not the same. This is, but I do think it's a really interesting parallel. Even the more interesting for those differences in those sort of more external circumstances. Yeah. Now, Alia's wondering what the significance is of the fact that the memories of walking with Bilbo, talking of adventures, that gives him courage. He thinks about Bilbo Baggins and his stories, right? So he's not just thinking of Bilbo's stories. He's thinking of Bilbo Baggins and his stories, right? He's imagining they're jogging together in the lanes of the Shire and talking about roads and adventures. The roads... of course, should remind us of the song, right? The road goes ever on and on song. And you see how that fits with the thoughts that we get from him at the end of the paragraph, right? The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began, right? Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can, pursuing it with weary feet, if you're Frodo, right? Until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then, I cannot say, right? Well, whither then has turned out to be in a barrow, right? Under the dreadful spells of a barrow white. He has come to the end of his road, and it's a terrible end at the end of his road. right? So that seems to me I thinking about roads and adventures, I can't help but think of the poem, and I think that that's you know, a big part of what we're supposed to be hearing there, right? And in a sense, it's that realization. On the one hand, you could say, well, that's kind of where the despair comes in, right? And yet, thinking about it in this context is the thing that fuels him, right? It's possible, Oakwig, that recalling Bilbo's successful adventure brings hope. But again, I don't see hope here. The hardening is not like, I can still get out of this. I don't see much evidence of Frodo thinking, if I just keep my head, I can still survive, right? I can still make it. What we do see is his determination to resist to the last, not to give in, not to just allow himself to be a helpless prey, right? JJ's asking, do we ever hear anything about Hobbit funerary practices? When were we talking about this? I had a long conversation with, in one of these streams, we talked for a while about Hobbit funerary practices. And finally I came up with one. There are very few references to it, but we do get one reference, and that is the grave. We know that hobbits bury their dead. Because remember the hobbits who are killed in the Battle of Bywater during the scouring of the Shire, and a stone is erected, right, with their names listed and everything. And that's the only reference I can think of to hobbit funerals or hobbit burials, but they do seem to bury their dead. But we don't see, I think it was in the context of Lotro somewhere, maybe it was in a Grifflet stream, I can't remember, when we're talking about like graveyards, hobbit graveyards, like never seeing any hobbit graveyards and wondering what they're like. Exactly. Catriona, it may be the end, but he's not going down without a fight. Yes, that's the mental state that he's in. And that is, he's not holding out for victory, right? He's not motivated by hope for victory. But that is victory, right? That's victory in this battle. Holding on to that resolution and not allowing himself to be a victim, not giving in to this fear that is surrounding him, I think literally, and not just figuratively. Let's keep going. As he lay there, thinking and getting a hold of himself, he noticed all at once that the darkness was slowly giving way. A pale greenish light was growing round him. It did not at first show him what kind of a place he was in, for the light seemed to be coming out of himself and from the floor beside him, and had not yet reached the roof or wall. He turned, and there in the cold glow he saw lying beside him Sam, Pippin, and Merry. They were on their backs, and their faces looked deathly pale. They were clad in white. About them lay many treasures, of gold maybe, though in that light they looked cold and unlovely. On their heads were circlets, gold chains were about their waists, and on their fingers were many rings. Swords lay by their sides, and shields were at their feet, but across their three necks lay one long naked sword. Okay. JJ, I don't know why Frodo was apart from the others. I have a theory, though. That is, I ask myself, what reason could there be, right? Why would the Barrow-wights put him aside separately? One possibility is that the other three managed to stay together, and Frodo was the only one who was separated out, so he was brought in separately and therefore treated separately. But I don't really believe that. I suspect that it's about the ring. Notice the others have been given rings, as Natvokius is just saying. The Barrow-wight is, you see what a good host he's being, right? Way above and beyond the call of duty. He's not only brought them into his home and made them comfortable, right? But he's given them rings, right? He's a ring giver, just like an Anglo-Saxon king. So that's all good, right? Frodo doesn't have any extra rings, it doesn't seem. There's no reference to treasure. He's clad in white, but there's no reference to other treasures on him. Yes, I mean, they are next to him. So, Brandon, I agree. There's no reason to think he's completely separate. But the sword isn't across his throat. It is across the other's throat. He didn't have to move the sword off of his throat in order to sit up, right? So it does seem that he's in a different place, at least a little bit. Yeah, Matt, I agree. The experience that they have is different, right? We'll see probably next week, you know, that Mary's famous comments, you know, the memories that he has when he wakes up, which are very strange, right? And Frodo doesn't have that experience. So he does seem to, for one reason or another, right? And we don't know exactly why he's not under the spells, or not under the same spells, or not in the same way, right? Now, I don't want to make too much of the Ring of Power here and his possession of the Ring of Power, because no reference is made to it. We're given no hints by the Whites that they notice it, care about it, anything like that. The only thing that we have is that Frodo does seem to be in a different place from the rest of them. At least slightly removed, or at least not with a sword around his neck. And there's a sense in which the whole tableau here, seems to be done to some extent for Frodo's benefit. Do you see what I mean? That is to say, notice the light, right? So the darkness, which, remember, was equated with the fear, right? Or at least very strongly associated with the fear that was threatening to choke him before. The darkness is fading because this pale greenish light is growing around him, which is pale greenish light is always bad, as we talked about before. The light seemed to be coming out of himself and from the floor beside him. This is why he can't see. He can see that there's light, but he can't see very much by it, because he seems to be shedding the light himself. He himself is aglow with this pale greenish light, this corpse light, this death light that is shining out of him. Also, not a good sign, right? And why? What's the point of the light? What does the light accomplish? What the light accomplishes is to illumine Sam and Pippin and Mary, right? It seems as if he is being shown them in his own death light, right? Again, the light that's coming is coming from him, and that light is just illumining his friends who are already laid out for a funeral, and a very fancy funeral, right? Where they're being buried like warriors, with their shields at their feet and swords by their sides. They're being laid out like great lords, right? With their jewels on them. Yeah, exactly. JJ was just pointing out the warrior thing. It is very much like Boromir. We will see Boromir being buried in not exactly the same way, but similar. I mean, definitely some similarities there. A ghost light, Tony, exactly. Matt points out that the light gives him something to be afraid of again. Exactly. I tend to think that this is basically the next move in the conflict between the White and Frodo, right? The first move was darkness and fear to get him to submit. Would he ever have been illuminated? Would he ever have seen Merry and Pippin and Sam by this pale light? Had he just given into the fear and lay like a limp and helpless prey? Probably not. I don't know, but probably not, right? This seems like this is this is the next move, right? This is the white upping the ante here. Look at your friends. Look at your friends lying dead. Well, not dead yet, right? Dead in life, right? Still living and yet laid out for death. Yeah, Valori says, the juxtaposition of these light-hearted country lads and the long-dead kings really weirded her out as a kid. It seems almost perverse and wrong. Yes, I mean, there's some... The solemnity of this scene is as chilling as any other element of it, right? Yes, Tony says, the hobbits being laid out like great warriors feels like mockery. I mean... not humorous mockery, right? No one's having fun with this. But yes, I mean, there is a sort of sardonic edge to it, perhaps. And Matt, you're right. The naked sword across their throats is clearly a sign. But again, someone's taken some time here, right? The Barrow White has had access to the unconscious bodies of Sam and Merry and Pippin for a while, right? They've been stripped, dressed, and decorated, right? And laid out in this quite elaborate way by the Barrowites, right? My point, again, really simple point. The Whites have had lots of opportunities to kill Sam and Pippin and Merry, right? Why not? Why haven't they killed them? Right? Why are they not dead? That's one of the reasons why this begins to look like a sort of pageant put on for Frodo's benefit, right? As those three, they're unconscious, they're in sort of a different place, I think spiritually, and we will talk about this next time or whenever we get to their recovery and see what happened with them so that we can compare with Frodo. But for now, the focus is on Frodo, so we need to focus on that. And again, the White's focus would seem to be on Frodo as well, right? Emma Thorne, I agree, ritual does seem to be more important to the Whites. But again, ritual has a point, right? There's a purpose to ritual. Something is being prepared. Something is being recalled. There's a meaning in ritual, right? Meaning, if you think about it, meaning is what separates ritual from mere routine, right? I do the same things when I get up in the morning, but it's not a ritual, right? Because it doesn't have meaning. Now, sometimes it can, you know, that kind of routine can acquire meaning, right? In which case, it does become something almost like a ritual. But again, to me, that's the difference between ritual and mere habit or routine, right? It has a meaning. So, what is the meaning? And notice we've turned on the stage lights, right, so that Frodo can see. And notice we're about to see the execution. They've waited until Frodo woke up, resisted them, and now they're going to kill the other three hobbits in front of him, right? This is part of the purpose, right? This is part of the meaning, right? Tony, it does feel like the preparation for an act of magic of some kind as well. Yes. The other thing that I think, because remember, there's another situation in which you dress somebody up really fancy and put them on a tomb, right? And that's when you're going to sacrifice them, right? Sacrifices get dandied up also before they're sacrificed. So there is something of ritual sacrifice in the deaths or the obviously contemplated deaths of Sam and Merry and Pippin. But again, Frodo's witnessing that. Frodo's responding to that, presumably responding to that in a particular way. Good Marianne was just saying the same thing. Absolutely. It's clearly part of the point, part of the whole show, right? For the Whites. And Lincoln, I agree. I think that both are involved. We get both the parody of the warrior's burial and a human sacrifice, right? That both of those, I can't separate either one of those from this situation. We see both of those things happening. And I think in order to understand the horrible spells of the Barrow Whites, we have to understand both of those different angles, right? To take life and to sacrifice it for some other purpose, right? But also that sort of parody of funerary ritual, right? The parody of the honoring of the dead. And think of how Boromir's burial, this is our big sort of model for this, right? Boromir's burial, to honor the dead, to honor their slain companion, was so important that even though they were in a very big rush, the three companions stopped to lay out Boromir appropriately, right? I mean, they were still efficient about it. They couldn't afford the time to build a cairn or something like that, right? But still, it was sufficiently important for them to do that they did it. So we have, and that's where I think Lincoln, it seems to me, not only just the warrior parody element of it, right, but the whole funeral parody element of it, really. But JJ, yeah, breaking Frodo's will seems to be a big part of what this particular ritual seems to be aimed at. Again, he seems to be the target audience here. Let's keep going. Suddenly a song began, a cold murmur, rising and falling. The voice seemed far away and immeasurably dreary, sometimes high in the air and thin, sometimes like a low moan from the ground. Out of the formless stream of sad but horrible sounds, strings of words would now and again shape themselves, grim, hard, cold words, heartless and miserable. The night was railing against the morning of which it was bereaved, and the cold was cursing the warmth for which it hungered. Frodo was chilled to the marrow. After a while, the song became clearer, and with dread in his heart, he perceived that it had changed into an incantation. First and most striking thing about this, notice the mixture of adjectives that Tolkien keeps using here, right? On the one hand, we get some strings of adjectives which are fairly similar, right? That is, like, grim, hard, cold, right? They're grim, they're hard, they're cold. Those are not adjectives that are sort of... There's no tension among those adjectives, right? But then we get these pairs where there is... where there is tension, right? Sad and horrible, heartless and miserable. One of those adjectives leads us to, you know, fear, revulsion, right? The other prompts pity and compassion. The sounds of the... And hang on, I'm forgetting the adjective. What was the adjective that he used? Dreadful. Dreadful spells of the Barrow-wides. Okay. Oop, not quite to the song yet. By the way, immeasurably dreary is one of my favorite phrases from this whole section. Horrible, heartless, right? Those are fairly clear cues for us and for our response to them, right? This is evil. This is something that is just on the opposite spectrum from everything warm and living and good and wholesome and everything else, right? Horrible and heartless. But they're not just horrible and heartless. The words of the white are not just horrible and heartless. They're also sad and miserable. And JJ, I agree that this does seem to be one of the general trends. Yes, I think that is the state of evil in general. Repulsive, horrible, and yet pitiful. All of the great villains, ultimately, in Tolkien, are both horrible and sad at the same time. One of the places where you notice this combination most sharply Kyle, exactly. You just got it exactly before as I was opening my mouth to say it. The description of Gollum in his cave is full of these kinds of pairings as well. He is a miserable wretch, right? He is a wretched, wicked creature. He's both wretched and wicked. No, there's no question about the one, right? He's bad. He's horrible. He does terrible things, and he plans to do more terrible things. But he's also wretched, miserable, pitiable. The fact that Gollum, having, you know, sort of unbeknownst to himself, recruiting Bilbo's sympathy, right? Recruiting Bilbo's pity for him is one thing. And because remember what the root, what is it that prompts Bilbo's pity, right? What prompts Bilbo's pity? What breaks him out of that despairing, desperate mood, Matt, that you were referring to earlier on, that you were reminding us of earlier on, which was like, though again different in its circumstances, from Frodo's initial fear and despair. What shakes Bilbo out of that is empathy, essentially. That is, he thinks of Gollum, and he pictures Gollum's situation, right? And he imagines himself in Gollum's place and how horrible Gollum's life must be. And that's what prompts his pity. Yes, Oakwig, you're right. Luthien de Karkaroth. With Luthien and Karkaroth, we see the same thing. What does she call Karkaroth? Oh, woe-begotten spirit, she calls him, right? And she puts him to sleep briefly and characterizes that as giving him some brief release from the horror of his own existence, right? It's pretty bad, right? It's the contemplating that existence is pretty horrible. So it's interesting to me that is the note that is struck here as Frodo is listening to the Whites. Right, we're getting a lot of this. We're getting a lot of this through, you know, sort of essentially through Frodo's perceptions. Right, so it would seem to me that these descriptions, these adjectives that we're getting describing the words and the singing, are essentially sort of hints as to what Frodo is thinking and how Frodo is feeling about this. And again, just as his being prepared for action despite his lack of hope was a good sign, his hearing the sound of the voices of the Whites and not simply being overcome with horror, but rather perceiving the sadness of it, that too, I think, is a very good sign. And Matt, as you say, the parallel with Bilbo continues here, right? With Bilbo at the end of chapter 5 of The Hobbit. His pity, his imagination, is rising. Out of the formless stream of sad but horrible sounds, even the very formlessness of the stream of sad sounds is sad, right? I mean, think of this horrible, empty, disjointed life. Unlife, right? That the Whites are apparently living. Even the sense of the moan coming from the ground, right? That's their life, moaning from the ground, right? Strings of words. Like, is it worse or is it better? If all it was moaning from the ground, that doesn't impress you with a sense of the sentience and awareness of the creature moaning? I mean, quite possibly, but again, that's not the real emphasis, right? I mean, you know, door hinges moan, right? But the fact that these strings of words, right, shape themselves, show there's still a mind, there's still an intelligence behind this misery, in the midst of this horror. And no matter how bad his own situation may be, no matter how imminent his own death and how terrible his end may seem to be, it's nothing on these poor creatures, right? These hideously twisted creatures. And because he hears it, right? What does he hear in those strings of words? And Tony, I agree, this is one of the great sentences in The Fellowship of the Ring. The night was railing against the morning of which it was bereaved, and the cold was cursing the warmth for which it hungered. Think about the two halves of that sentence, right? The night, and notice how this echoes the sad but horrible element of this whole scene, right? The night railing against the morning is one thing, right? It's just saying like that. I mean, that sounds like a simple black and white kind of issue, right? The darkness hates the light. And so the darkness hates the morning because the morning is the end of the darkness, right? So it's just like the darkness hates the light because it's evil, right? And the light is good, and it's going to lose because the morning is going to come and the darkness is going to be driven away. So of course the darkness hates the morning, right? But then we get, so that's kind of the horrible element, right? But then we get, of which it was bereaved. Bereaved, such an interesting word here, right? Like, it's been taken away from it. The night's relationship with the morning, right, is like a living person's relationship with a dead relative, right? It's bereavement. It's grief. And that's different. It's not just horrible. It's also sad, right? The night has lost something. It's lost the morning. And so it's railing against it, which is also, in a sense, kind of like railing against itself, right? Against its own situation. And yes, Tony, since evil is in its nature is the absence of something good, it makes sense that the hatred of what it's missing would be the result. Yeah, yeah, exactly. The cold was cursing the warmth for which it hungered. Cursing the warmth for which it hungered. And Tony, exactly what you're saying. What do we see here? The coldness desires the warmth. Well, of course it does, right? We can see in that the remnants, the poor remnants of a good and positive thing. Of course, that which is cold would like to be warm, right? That desire for the warmth is a good desire. But the hunger, right? It wants to feed on it. It wants to consume it. It has this hideously self-centered desire for the warmth, right? And yet all the time that it's desiring the warmth, it is cursing the warmth that it desires. It doesn't want to desire the warmth anymore, but it can't help but desire the warmth anymore. This is both heartless and miserable, right? Matt, I agree that the hungering for the warmth, certainly thinking of both of Ungoliant and of Melkor's hunger and desire for the Silmarils and for the light, is the relationship between Melkor and the light is really interesting, right? And I think sort of similar, the burned hand of Melkor. I think in the burned hand of Melkor, we can see this same kind of cursing the warmth for which it hungered kind of dynamic going on there. Hrothgar points out that both night and cold here in this sentence are craving something that would cause them to cease to exist, right? Yeah, if the cold is warmed, it won't be cold anymore, right? When the morning comes, the night is past. And yet, that, you know, the whites crave an ending to their miserable existence. Yes, Hrothgar. And yet they curse it, right? They hate it. Hate it because it doesn't come, but also hate the fact that they want it, even, it seems. Railing against that of which you are bereaved, right? It's tough. Both JJ and Nutvilicus at the same time said they hate it and love it as they hate and love themselves. Yeah, exactly. Again, another Gollum connection, right? I think we can learn a lot about, you know, this is a sort of good kind of pre-gaming for Gollum, right? A good little insight that will help us when we get there. And yes, Marianne, I agree. There's not only hatred, but envy here as well, right? That's the other thing, is that they know the cold knows that it is not warm, right? The night knows that it is not light, that it is not bright, right? And it wants those things, and it hates those things, and it hates itself for wanting those things. It's all very horrible and sad. So, the song is the next move, right? Once again, we can see the sort of struggle of wills between the whites and Frodo, right? And I think his own reaction, the pity with which this whole passage is laced, right, really emphasizes Frodo's positive response, right? Again, I think Frodo is winning here. At the least, he's holding his own, and he's holding his own pretty well. But then the song becomes an incantation, meaning it becomes a song, the kind of song that makes stuff happen, right? Not just a song about the darkness and the cold and stuff like that, but something which is trying to do something to someone else, which is why when Frodo recognizes that it's an incantation and not just a song, right, that he gets that dread in his heart. Okay. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone, nevermore to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. In the black wind the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie, till the dark lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. This is a really creepy poem. JJ, we'll talk about the meter in a minute. I think the meter is really interesting in this song, actually. But let's talk about the content of it first, and then we'll come back to the meter. Cold be hand and heart and bone. First, let's notice the, as always, remember my first rule of poetic interpretation, right? And this is where I feel that English teachers often do a disservice to students. Sometimes people talk about poetry as if it's just all about feelings. Like, how does that make you feel, right? And I'm interested in how it makes you feel. Like, that's relevant. But that's not the first thing that you should talk about, or at least if you kind of think about that, you need to move on, right? Because what really matters is the plot, right? What is it actually saying? People sometimes will talk about poetry and forget that it has, you know, grammar and syntax. You know, it has sentences and is conveying something, in fact, right? So let's look at this. What is the first, well, not quite so. I want to look at the first two lines. What is the purport of the first two lines? First of all, notice, what is the mood of the verb of this sentence? Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone. What is the mood of the verb? I don't think it is imperative. The be is the important thing, right? And there is an imperative sense always implied in a kind of incantation, right? I tend to think it's subjunctive as well. Let the hand be cold. Let also the heart and bone be cold. Let the sleep under stone be cold. Right. Which is in this context, it is like imperative. Right. But it's not a command. That is a command has like that implied you. Right. As the implied second person as the subject of it. He's not saying you be cold. Right. If he were just saying that, like, be cold, wake no more, right? That would be imperative. He would then be addressing Frodo directly, right? And he would be telling him, like ordering him to do something. But that's not exactly what he's, again, it's similar. I'm kind of splitting hairs here, but I think it's interesting. I think it's important, right? Because I don't think that you is the subject of these sentences. And it's not Frodo that he's talking to. The subject of the verb be is hand and heart and bone, right? It can't be indicative, Tungle, because it's not conjugated properly for indicative. You don't use be other than in an infinitive in the indicative. Be is it's got to be. When you're using be, in a present tense, it's got to be either subjunctive or imperative. And I think it's subjunctive. Again, may the hand, heart, and bone be cold. Let it be cold. Let it become cold, right? Let the sleep under stone be cold. And again, it's still imperative in the sense of like trying to make something happening. But it's not, again, it's not a command of Frodo personally. He's not saying, hey, you, Frodo, engage your will in this way. Perform this action, right? Rather, he's saying, let this state of affairs come to pass in your hand, your heart, your bone, right? Let your sleep. And first of all, I'm not even exactly, Matt, that's exactly Matt saying it better than I am. He says, if it were imperative, it would be commanding Frodo to act. Right, that is to say, it would be like trying to compel his will to perform an action. And the reason I think it's important that it's subjunctive rather than imperative is that that's not what's involved here. Matt says it's a command for a change of state of existence. It's an attempt to rewrite reality. Yes. Now there is an appeal to Frodo's will here, but it's more indirect. Right. The appeal to Frodo's will, or rather the attack on Frodo's will, is submit to this. Let this be, right? Let this be. Because he wants this to be. He is attempting to make this to be. Nevermore to wake on... Erokeb is pointing out that it's roughly equivalent to a third-person imperative in many languages. English doesn't really have that, or doesn't really use that so much, but I agree. Again, I'm not arguing against the general imperative sense. Like, it's imperative in the sense that he's trying to make something happen, right? But again, it's not a command of Frodo, is the important point, I think. Tony, exactly. What's happening is something like a perverted Ea, right? Let these things be. Remember, that's the Silmarillion translation of the word Ea. Let these things be is exactly what the white is saying here. Okay. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone, never more to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. We get a period. Okay, so this poem is 8 lines long. we get two sentences, right? Each of the four lines, the first four lines, second four lines, the syntax of these lines separates it into two different quatrains, right? And that also fits because in The Black Wind, the stars shall die. Notice we get a change in the mood of the verb, right? Now we're in indicative, future indicative. Now he's making a statement of fact about the future, right? He's not making a statement of fact about the future in the first four lines. He is wishing these things to be. Never more to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. And then it shifts. So notice what's missing from lines 3 and 4. Like the subject, right? That is to say, never more to wake on stony bed. Who? Sam and Mary and Pippin? Frodo? Possibly. I mean, presumably they're all involved, you know, in this incantation. I'm not saying that it's not relevant to them. But again, the interesting thing, syntactically, they're not in this sentence, right? Hand, heart, bone. Those are the things that are being described, right? Never more to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. Is this talking about death or not? Is this talking about never more to wake? So are they going to go into oblivion, right? Yes, both J.J. and Natvilikus are pointing out this sounds like a description of his own existence, right? Remember the cold that is... I want to make sure I get the phrasing right, right? Cursing, that's right. The cold is cursing the warmth for which it hungered, right? Cold be hand and heart and bone. They are warm, and he's trying to make them cold, right? If their hands, hearts, and bones are cold, and they sleep a cold sleep under the stone, never more to wake, never. Until the sun fails and the moon is dead. So until the end of Arda, right, until the end of the world, they are never more to wake. Matt says that his incantation is writing Frodo out of his own story, hence the lack of a subject. Yeah. This applies to sort of every... So there are two ways that I think it's sort of interesting here. One is this applies to everybody. Does it apply to Frodo? Yeah. Does it apply to Sam and Merry and Pippin? Yeah. Does it apply to the White himself? Yeah. Right? Like, he's also reiterating his own existence and saying, you're going to be like me. Lincoln, exactly. I remember talking about that before as well. That this is the curse, right? Remember all that sad and horrible stuff before? May you be exactly like me is a pretty horrible curse for them to put under. But I also like thinking about the not just saying, hey, it's you, it's them, it's me, but it's abstract, right? It's not about people at all. It's about hand and heart and bone, because you know what? That's all you are. Who are you? Alone, yourself, and nameless. This is what you are, alone and nameless, right? Welcome to the alone and nameless club, guys, right? You are nothing but a hand, heart, and bone, which is just going to lie here cold under the stone. I'm not even going to address your whole body, right? I'm just going to anatomize you because you are nameless, right? You're nobody anymore, right? You will be nobody. You're never more going to wake, but you're sleeping, but you're never going to wake, but you're not going to be oblivious, right? So I think that, you know, both of those things are all kind of involved there. Second quatrain. In the black wind, the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie till the dead lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. Till the Dark Lord. I said dead lord, didn't I? Till the Dark Lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. Oh, Dead Lord kind of works too in the context. In the black wind, the stars shall die. Again, that change of the mood of the verb is a really interesting movement here, right? And it picks up on the concept of the last line, Finn, exactly as you said. We ended with, "You're nevermore shall you wake till the sun fails and the moon is dead." Speaking of which, let's talk a little bit more about the end of the world, shall we? The white seems to say. In the black wind, the stars shall die. That's the end of the world, right? And still on gold here, let them lie. Who? Frodo? Let them still lie here? Sort of a general, let them all four still lie here? Till the Dark Lord lifts his hand over Dead Sea and withered land. And, you know, Marianne, as you were just asking, and as Brandon was just asking too, I'm never sure which Dark Lord he's talking about. Is this Sauron or is this Morgoth that he's talking about? Or it could be Pontin, as you say, could even be the Witch King of Angmar, whom we know, whom we're told sent the spirits into the Barrow Downs. So it was at his command that these spirits entered these barrows in the first place. But I do tend to think that Dark Lord is probably not the Witch King of Angmar, is probably Morgoth or Sauron. I think it's probably Morgoth here, that the Dark Lord is going to lift his hand over Dead Sea and withered land, which is yeah, Darren, I tend to agree that, you know, the one who's going to be lifting his hand after the sun fails and the moon is dead, that this, it's going to be Morgoth. They're going to be fighting at the Dagor Dagorath, right? You know, at the Battle of Battles at the Apocalypse. It's not going to be Sauron. Sauron's not going to be the big bad at the battle at the end of days, right? When it comes time for the Middle Earth Ragnarok, it's not going to be Sauron who's going to be the primary enemy. I agree that it's more likely to be Morgoth, but I think it's interesting, and you know, and Tony, I think you pick up on this really well. It's interesting that we don't know for sure. I don't think we're even compelled to decide which one it might be. Tony says he thinks it's a general desire for the conquest of evil, and any Dark Lord will do, right? The one thing that leads me to hesitate over the sort of going all the way with any Dark Lord will do is the future indicative, right? This is, the incantation has mingled with a prophecy, right? It is, the voice is prophesying that the stars shall die in the black wind. The sun's going to fail, the moon's going to die, and the stars will die. The stars will die in the black wind, and the Dark Lord is going to lift his hand over Dead Sea and withered land. That's going to happen, right? Future indicative. Let them lie. Let them lie. Back to the subjunctive, right? Let them lie still on gold until all that stuff happens, right? So the sort of prophecy element of it there is what kind of leads me to think that it's probably thinking specifically of events rather than just kind of a general sort of generic conflict of evil. But and it is the Dark Lord Hrothgar, as you say. It's not capitalized, no capital D, capital L, but we do at least get a definite article, so there is that. Yeah. Now, Kyle, that's a really interesting observation. Kyle says it's interesting that, you know, Frodo, thinking he had come to his final moments, was finding his own will and resolve hardening, right? And Marianne, by the way, you had mentioned before that it's like the Battle of Maldon. Yeah, exactly. Of course, when Sam hardens in Mordor, it's going to be a much more explicit reference to that moment in the Battle of Maldon that you're remembering, Mary. But that same concept, I think, is at play here. Anyhow, so Kyle was saying here's Frodo thinking he's coming to the terrible end of his road, and what does the White Star singing about but the true end, right, of all things, that everybody's the all of creation is on a road to a terrible end, right? And that's at least what he is predicting. Oh, and yes, Valor, of course, yes, you're right. It's not just Ragnarok. I was thinking of Ragnarok, not because I've seen the movie, because I haven't yet, though I really want to, but because I've been reading Norse mythology recently, and also because the whole like big battle with evil at the end, the one brief depiction that we get of that always sounded a little Ragnarok-y to me, rather than merely, the night falling on Narnia, for instance, in the last battle. It comes across very differently in Tolkien's world. But anyway, okay. Notice, this is one of the things that always struck me most, years ago about this poem, is the sort of the frank acknowledgement of what winning looks like for the bad guys, right? Thanks, Brandon. Brandon says that Ragnarok-y is a great adjective. I'm a fan of it, actually. Yeah, that was spontaneous, but I also like that as well. The frank admission of the fact that when evil wins, it's going to suck for everybody, even evil people, right? I mean, it's like, congratulations, Dark Lord, you won. Here's what it looks like. Lifting your hand, right, in authority, in conquest, over a dead sea and a withered land. Congratulations. Enjoy that, right? He's not going to enjoy it. They know he's not going to be enjoying it, right? There's enjoying things is not on the table, right? And they know it's not on the table. That's why their voices are sad as well as horrible, right? But nevertheless, it doesn't like change their minds, right? It doesn't lead them to think that maybe this whole, maybe they should leave this whole darkness and coldness thing and, you know, get a better paying gig. They are resolved, right? They are seeking this almost out of spite, like out of that envy, right? The cold curses the warmth for which it hungers, because it is warm and it is like it recognizes that it has something that it doesn't have. It's given up, frankly given up on getting it for itself. It doesn't want to be warmed. It just wants to make the warmth cold, right? It doesn't want to improve its lot. It doesn't want, this is the end of evil, right? This is the terrible end that Morgoth's road leads to, that Sauron's road following his master, right? On his dreadful path into the void. This is what Gollum's path, this is what Saruman's path, everybody who goes down this road, this is what the end of the road looks like, right? Lifting your hand over a dead sea and withered land. In Paradise Lost, Satan says that it's better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Actually, no, it's not. Right? That seems to be, I mean, there's a sense in which I think the last two lines of this poem are, I'm not saying that he was attempting to rebut Paradise Lost, but it's a kind of, it serves as a kind of rebuttal, right? It's like, how's that reigning in hell working out for you, right? It's not actually better, right? Even to, and again, and this, of course, I'm thinking of Boethius, which we just read in the Mythgard Academy. Even somebody who wants power, somebody who wants pleasure, right? Somebody who wants wealth, a wicked person who does wicked things in order to get those things is not yet all bad. Even they may be doing horrible things, right? In order to serve their own pleasure, in order to increase their own power. But so long as that, but there's something positive, even pleasure, even if you're taking pleasure in horrible things, the pleasure itself means you're not all the way at the bottom of the pit, right? You still have further that you could fall from there. This is what the bottom of the pit looks like, right? When you get to this point, when what you're looking out for is just for everything else to be destroyed because you are reconciled to everything, to your own perfect and complete misery for all eternity, that's the bottom, right? That's really the bottom. Yeah, exactly. And Lincoln, no, I don't think that Milton actually ultimately does support. I think that I have always thought that people who think that Milton is like really behind Satan are missing the. I don't think Milton. I think that here's the way I would say it. I think that many readers of Milton are bigger suckers than Milton was. I don't think he was suckered by that. He gives Satan lots of really good speeches, but I don't think at the end of the day, Milton actually buys those speeches. But he does justice to him. Anyway. All right. Meter. Let's talk about meter. What's the fundamental meter of this poem? Right. Oh, and Tim Dolph, that's exactly what I'm saying. As long as you have perverted good, you're not at the bottom. Complete privation is the bottom of the well, right? And that's exactly what we're going for here, right? That's exactly the consummation devoutly to be wished, according to the Barrow-Wite, is privation, right? Everything being dead, everything being empty, everything being cold, everything being hungry, and unable to be satisfied. Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Yes, Eroheb, iambic tetrameter. This is an iambic, right? That's the really important thing. In fact, many of the lines, not all of them, but many of the lines are extremely regular. Look at line 2. And cold be sleep under stone. Under is a variation, right? And cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep, right? All the way through there, perfectly even iambs, right? And we get one completely completely perfect iambic line, don't we? And still on gold here let them lie. Yeah, right? 8 syllables, perfectly iambic, right? So notice the one quick thing, right? They're iambic, right? They are the opposite of Tom Bombadil, who is trochaic. And I think that that's not an accident, because Tom Bombadil's trochees are about to come and interrupt this miasma of despairing and horrible iambs that we're getting, right? Now, the fun thing... the fun thing about this poem about meter, Nat Vilkia says, "I wonder what does this say about Tolkien's opinions of iambs?" Now, it's not that he's anti-iamb. Remember, Hobbit meter is an iambic tetrameter. The hobbits always sing an iambic. Elvish meter is iambic. So it's not that iambs are evil, and yet there's a trend. Right? This really creepy poem is iambic. And remember, the ring verse, Sauron's quotation is iambic, which contrasts with the generally trochaic remainder of the ring poem, right? The 3 rings for the elven kings under the sky, 7 for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone. And then one ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all and in the darkness bind them, right? Really even sinister IMs at the end, right? Nat Vilkius, I agree. All of the evil poetry has been iambic. Now, most of the poetry, period, is iambic in English. So that's, you know, you can make that argument to say, statistically speaking, most of it, most evil poetry will be iambic. But nevertheless, I think that it is interesting. And it hits me harder here because we've been immersed in trochees, right, for like a chapter and a half in the House of Tom Bombadil. We've been in a very trochaic state of mind. And we should still kind of have that in our heads, right? Ho, Tom Bombadil, Tom Bombadillo. And think of the differences, right? I had an errand there, gathering water lilies. How different that sounds from be hand and heart and bone and cold be sleep under stone. The best poetry professor I ever had in grad school, what he always used to say, and this is something that has really influenced me throughout my poetic interpretation career. He used to say that sometimes people, when they're talking about poetry, talk about a variation in the meter, right? Like they would say that under stone, for instance, is a variation in the meter, or cold in the first line, right? Because the stress is on the first syllable. Cold is obviously stressed, right? So the rest of it is perfectly iambic, be hand and heart and bone, but cold at the beginning. If it's iambic, the first syllable should be unstressed, like in the second line, and cold be sleep, right? But we get a stress on the first syllable, which is a variation from the iambic meter. But the thing that my old professor always used to say is meter is invariable. Don't ever talk about it varying, because it doesn't. The whole point of what a great poet does in a metrical poem is that first, like, the poem starts the metronome going in your head. You can hear it, and it's invariant, right? And cold be sleep under stone. That doesn't mean the poem itself is invariant, right? But the meter never varies. So what happens is, where are those moments when the poet, when the natural inflection of the English words differ from the meter, right? When do we get things that are, you know, if once our ears pick up on the rhythm, once we get the rhythm, then the poet by creating a difference, a gap between the actual stress of the lines and it was the ictus and the stress, my old professor always used to say. The ictus means the metronome beat, right? The stress is how the words actually come out, right? Where there's a gap between those, where there's a strain between those, is where are the words that really jump out to us, right? And that's a way that the poet will give us a cue to pay attention to stuff. So, for instance, the fact that the first word of the poem is cold, we'd probably notice that anyway, right? But he makes bloody sure we recognize it, right? That we hear it. Because that word, for the first line and a half, that one word is the only moment when the stress of the line differs from the beat of the meter, right? So that word cold just rings in those first two lines. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone. Notice how cold the second time does fit with the meter. But it's hard. Notice how I kind of stressed that a little bit more. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep, right? We wouldn't have that. Leave out the first one, right? It wouldn't make sense, but again, just leave it out, right? Be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone. The word cold doesn't jump out, right? And it's not just the repetition. It's the fact that we get that bell note at the beginning. cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep. We can't not stress it, right? So, and it, so it, it underscores the repetition there, right? Cold is the dominant sense there, in the first. What's the other place where those lines differ, where the stress of those lines differs from the meter? Under, right? And cold be sleep. You can't do that. You just can't read English and fit the stress or fit the meter, right? And cold be sleep under stone. It doesn't work, right? And cold be sleep under stone. What's the effect? There's a syllable. So like, how does he achieve that effect? He achieves that effect not by putting in something extra, but by skipping something. There should be an unstressed syllable. And cold be sleep under stone. Only 7 syllables in that line. We need an 8th syllable to be perfect iambic tetrameter, right? The syllable that's missing is an unstressed syllable between sleep and und, right? Which means that just the natural stress of the line, the natural stress of the words compel us to pause there, to pause where that extra beat should be, and cold be sleep under stone, right? Which again draws our attention to where they're sleeping, right? It's the fact that they're sleeping. It's that they're sleeping under the stone, which of course also brings us back to the cold, which the meter stressed at the very beginning, right? So you see how that works? So this is what's fun, right? This is what's fun, is sort of seeing how, because this variation, any poet with any kind of, now sometimes a poet doesn't, like, varies from, you know, it has the stress differ from the meter all over the place just because the poet doesn't have a very good ear. That's not Tolkien. Tolkien's ear is awesome, right? He has a very carefully attuned ear, and he loves rhythm. He loves rhythm even in his prose, right? Much less in his verse, or much more in his verse, rather. Now, I'm not saying that every variation of the stress from the meter is necessarily deeply significant, right? But it kind of is, actually, in the sense that it has to jump out at you. It makes you pause. It makes you stumble. It makes you stress things. And we should pay attention to where that happens, because Tolkien's ear would have told him that he knew that was happening, right? It's one of the things that he's going for when he constructs these lines. Nevermore to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. The fourth line, Tarlonio was just talking about that. The fourth line is weird. Let's look at that. First of all, notice how long that line is. Hang on, let's count. Never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. That's 11 syllables in that line, right? That is whacked, right? There are 3 extra syllables in that line. Never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. Well, where are the extra ones, right? Okay. Sometimes poets, really good poets, will do awesome things with this kind of thing. My favorite example of this is in John Donne, his Batter My Heart, Three Person God, where he has a line which has, because it's talking about his own pride, this one line, and it's an iambic pentameter, I believe, but there are 11 syllables. There's an extra syllable, and it doesn't scan right. And the extra word, like, there's the one syllable that if you take it out, it's the line is perfect. And goes, and guess what the syllable is? I, right? Because it's, anyway, I mean, how cool is that, right? Really, really great poets do awesome things with this kind of variation in meter. Where's the extra? Yes, Erochab, I totally agree. Never is obviously extra, right? It's extra in the sense that he's just said it, right? We don't need it. And metrically, I mean, it's an entire extra foot that's thrown in there. And it's clear that it's extra because the line keeps on coming, right? Take it out, right? Nevermore to wake on stony bed till the sun fails and the moon is dead. Now, that's still one syllable extra, but that would sound much more normal, wouldn't it? Nevermore to wake on stony bed till the sun fails and the moon is dead. It's still an irregular line, but it works, right? But the white didn't do that, right? We get that extra foot, and we get that extra foot for a reason. Why? It's like the white is messing up his own verse, right? Why? Because he wants to repeat the never, right? He is willing to repeat the never, even at the cost of screwing up the meter of the poem, much worse in that line than anywhere else, right? Even though it's completely extraneous, he's going to repeat the never, right? Never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. Just a few other... points from the other lines. Again, just listen to those places of variation, right? In the black wind, the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie. Listen to those two lines. What words jump out at you? In the black wind, the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie. Think of just the rhythm now. Rhyme is another thing, and I agree that die and lie are important because they're rhyme. We don't ignore rhyme, right? Rhyme is an important tool too, but I want to talk about rhythm primarily. In those two lines, where is the only place that the stress of the line differs from the meter, iambic tetrameter? In the black wind, the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie. Black wind. Absolutely. Black wind. In the black wind. Really, that whole phrase. After in the black wind, it's smooth sailing. Now, several of you are saying, like, still jumps out, gold jumps out, in the sense that they're stressed syllables. Yes. And by the way, that's a whole other element, right, of the application of meter, right? Which words you choose to make stressed in the line is important. And again, sometimes sometimes a great poet can do really fun things with that. My favorite example of that one is Shakespeare. In Macbeth, people so often don't read Shakespeare like it's poetry, but it is, and often you get really awesome effects. Like, for instance, Macbeth's famous line, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. According to the meter, where is the stress? The stress is on the ands, right? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, right? Normally, we wouldn't stress the ands if we're just saying that in prose, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And too many actors just do the thing in prose, right? In sort of dramatic prose, but it's not prose. Macbeth's stress is on the ands, because that's what he's bothered by. It's not tomorrow that bothers him, it's the ands. And tomorrow, and tomorrow. It's the creeping on its weary pace from day to day that he is concerned about, right? Anyway, so you're right that the stressed syllables are important. Just read the stressed syllables. Right? Starting in the second half of the line. Stars, die, still, gold, let, lie. It tells the story, right? So you're right to focus on those. The stress, the very coordination of the stress and the meter really, really drive those home, right? But the variation from the meter, where the meter is at stress with the stress, intention with the stress, right, is at the beginning. In the black wind, the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie. Black wind. Black wind is spondaic, right? That it, spondaic just means two stressed syllables in a row, right? A foot with, instead of having unstressed stressed or stressed unstressed, just has stressed stressed. Remember, Tom Bombadil's lines tend to start with spondy. Old Tom Bombadil. Three stressed syllables in a row is a very common pattern for the beginning of Tom Bombadil's lines. I had an errand there. In the black wind, the stars shall die. You can, black wind, right? That phrase, black wind. And it's like Tungle, it's like sleep under stone. We get two stressed syllables in a row there. But again, notice how the effect is different. In sleep under stone, the effect is to make us pause because it's missing a syllable, right? There kind of should be an unstressed syllable there, but there isn't. So it makes us pause. And cold be sleep under stone, right? This doesn't make us pause. Instead, it makes it like puts little flashing lights. I guess they'd be black lights, right? Around the phrase black wind. Right, it really wants us to think about that black wind. In the black wind, the stars shall die. Now, why? What is the effect of that? Right. Well, the effect of that is to notice, hey, we're not just talking about the end of the world, people. We're talking about the end of the world, right? But that doesn't. But please do not think I'm just talking about the world winding down in a natural way, right? Like this is just the way things were always meant to be. Oh no, no, this is evil winning, right? Why are the stars dying? Not just because they've come to the end of their natural life, but because they're being killed and consumed by the black wind, right? The night is finally going to be victorious over the light. The cold is finally going to be victorious over the warmth, and it's everything's going to be cold and everything's going to be dark and everything's going to suck for everybody. That's what's going to happen, right? And that's the emphasis, right? So the emphasis is on this, which, and it's not made the subject, right? It's not the subject of the verb, right? He could do that, right? He could be like, and the black wind shall kill the stars, right? But he doesn't do that, right? In the black, he just, in the black, the stars shall die in the black wind. It's an adverbial phrase, right? The stars shall die. In what manner, by what agent shall the stars die? In the black wind. Right, that is the circumstances under which the stars will die, right? So it seems like syntactically, grammatically, it's not really strongly enforced, but the meter makes sure that we really pay attention to that, right? In the black wind, the stars. Now keep listening. In the black wind, the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie till the dark lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. What do you hear in those last few lines? What jumps out from the meter? Again, by jumps out, I primarily mean where does it differ, right? Where do we hear those discrepancies? Dead Sea, yes. Yes, Dead Sea, another piece of spondy there at the end. Over Dead Sea and withered land. Dark Lord is another one, right? Notice how these are all working the same. Black Wind, Dark Lord, Dead Sea. In fact, those three spondaic phrases tell the story of themselves, right? Black Wind, Dark Lord, Dead Sea, right? And Withered Land. Withered Land is interesting. Technically, that scans over Dead Sea and Withered Land. Those last four syllables are iambic. Neatly iambic. And yet, withered. By itself, the word withered is trochaic. And notice, go up to the really even. Look at the lines where the barrel white is doing really even iambs. What do you notice about the words? Be hand and heart and bone and cold, be sleep under stone. The stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie. What do you notice about that? Every single word in those really regular bits, velori exactly, are monosyllabic, right? He is arranging these one-syllable words to make the iambic pattern. Withered is a two-syllable word, which is intrinsically trochaic, stress on the first syllable. And then on the second solo, again, it fits, but it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit as tidily over Dead Sea and Withered Land. Withered. It's hard not to say the word withered. Again, the natural stress of that word is sort of at variance with the the pattern, not the rhythm exactly, but with the pattern of it. And thus I can't help but stress the withered, the first syllable of withered, a little bit more strongly. Yeah, Matt, goodness, you're right. I didn't even really notice that. I mean, I was noticing the thing about the iambs, but there's a pretty short list of two-syllable words in this entire poem. Under, never, twice, stony, and withered. That's it. Under, never, stony, withered. Golly. Right? Yeah. Over Dead Sea and Withered Land. Now, over. Oh, sorry, over is another two-syllable word. Yeah, over Dead Sea and Withered Land. The other reason that last line, the stress of that last line is a little bit more trochaic to me, is over as well. Over Dead Sea. It's different from starting with a stress like cold, right? Over Dead Sea and Withered Land. Apart from the fact that it's not long enough, that last line could be a Tom Bombadil line. Right? Over Dead Sea and Withered Land. Again, it's kind of hard to separate the content of it, right? Tom Bombadil wouldn't be talking about that. It's interesting that it closes off with this sort of trochaic feel. But again, the emphasis of it is that that last line, it makes that last line really ring, right? If we are lulled, as I think we are lulled, by the stars shall die and still on gold here let them lie, till the dark Lord lifts his hand over Dead Sea and Withered Land. You just read those last two lines, and I can't help but hear, till dark Lord, Dead Sea, Withered Land. Right? The main point just are heavily emphasized by the way in which it breaks away from the meter there at the end. Okay, all right. So I got a little bit more detailed about the meter, but isn't this? But I thought this actually was a really great illustration. Isn't that fun? Right? I'm telling you, meter is so much fun to look at. And the more you can train your ear, the more you can practice your ear to just hear that metronome going, right? So that the variations, the way that the stress doesn't fit the meter, that kind of jumps out at you. It just gives you a whole new sort of set of tools, right? A whole new set of observations to bring, you know, you get the, what does the rhythm emphasize? What does the rhyme emphasize? What is the content emphasizing? The sort of overall structure. All of it gives us like more data to use to draw some really interesting conclusions. All right. Okay. It's late. So we'll have to wait on the disembodied threat when the hand creeps. So we'll start with the creeping hand next time. And then pay attention to what happens immediately after the disembodied hand comes creeping in. One of the things that I didn't notice for years about this scene. All right. But I think we're gonna stop there because it's and so next week my plan and hope is that our field trip next week will be to the Barrow Downs. We're gonna look at the Barrow, having seen the inside of the Barrow and how this plays out. We should be able to get to Tom Bombadil's intervention next week. I want to do a tour in game of the Barrow Downs and look inside some of the barrows and see those things working out there in how they're doing, how they adapt that stuff in the game world. So field trip time tonight. We're gonna continue. So tonight I want to continue our look at the North Downs, which we've been doing, and then we will again hopefully get to the Barrow Downs next time. So exactly, Hrothgar, we can't exactly go to the Barrow Downs before we deal with the creeping hands in the text. I totally agree with you there. All right, so I'm gonna say goodbye to Twitter folks. Thanks for those of you who've been joining me on the Twitter broadcast. So I'm going to say goodbye to them. Thank you. And all right. So we're going to continue here on Twitch. Everybody stretch out and get ready to go here. All right.
Evening, everyone.
Okay, so I think I'm gonna stable master it up to Esteldine again.
Yeah, sounds good.
Which is right where we... took off last time. I want to head out the other side of Esteldine and start looking at see how much of the eastern end of the North Downs we can get through tonight.
Cool, should be good for that today.
Alright, so Valori JJ was asking about, he's like, I got a level 23 who needs to go up. Can they How would you recommend that?
Well, I think
that
you have to be level 25 to purchase a stable ride unless you use a mithril coin to find the stable.
Okay.
So they can spend a mithril coin and get up there with the stable, or you can also piggyback. You can go from Trestle Bridge and Trestle Bridge to Esteldine if you've already found those locations.
Right. Which at level 23 is unlikely.
No, I did it at 14, actually. So.
Oh, yeah? Well, there you go. Wow, I just like jumped up on top of the door there.
We're trapped forever. Yeah. We'll never get out of this room. Man, I haven't analyzed poetry like that in a long time. That was so metal, though. It was such a metal passage.
Yeah.
Now, do we know if have any artists taken that one as well? I know Christopher Lee did that one for the Rivendell ones done by the Scandinavian group.
Which ones? Which scene exactly? Are you talking about artists doing?
That poem. Christopher Lee recites all the poems in one album.
Right.
Of,
what
I think,
do you mean?
Poems in An Evening in Rivendell, or?
Yes.
Yeah. You watch True Terror. It's Christopher Lee reciting that poem, I tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, I just forgot. I always have this problem.
What's that? You don't have it?
I don't have it because I keep forgetting. I'm like, I'll just use a mithril coin, but I keep forgetting that my mithril coins aren't account based, but server based.
Well, we can ride up there.
I think I might have to.
That'll help out the 20 something guy.
That's true.
All right, let's go for it then. Should we meet up at the crossroad and make sure everybody's there? I think a lot of people went on ahead, though.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay, oh, you mithril coin, JJ, that's good.
Oh, no, I'm waiting on you.
Okay, no, the level 23 mithril coined it.
It's still worth getting. It's much easier than riding up by yourself, especially if you're under level.
Yeah. Yeah, darn it.
Do you have the journeyman riding trait, or are you stuck on the slow version?
I don't even remember. Actually, I think I could worsteed it, actually.
I have a muster to Esteldine. I just got a gift of the Valar, so now I have muster to Esteldine. Is that just me, or can I take other people? I forget what the warden rules are.
I have no idea.
Me neither. I've never played a warden before. I picked a poor class to go ahead and...
Yeah, I've never wardened either. Hang on a second. I do have a war steed. Hang on a second. Let's do that. At least we'll be a little bit faster.
Yeah.
Okay. The first time this character's ever... I'm getting tutorials now.
Oh, man. At least they didn't port you off to Rohan.
Yeah, exactly. Make me run around in circles and go through gates.
Play jousting with the dummy.
Yes.
I gotta admit, that was fun the first time I did it, but...
I'll never forget the first time I did it in that stream I did a year ago.
Yeah, I remember.
When I was lagging so terribly, I couldn't even see the gates.
I think it was lagging so badly, I couldn't watch it. I got kicked off or something.
Yeah.
But, my van died, so I had to have a rental. And the rental turned corners about as fast as one of those roar steeds. Not recommend the Dodge Grand Caravan.
Yeah,
it was immediately what I was thinking of. I'm just kind of like, oh man.
Yeah, I think if you're in a rental car and it's turning corners and making you think of a Lotra war steed, that's really certainly a bad sign.
Yeah, but I really had to just, you know, ram my foot down on the gas to make it go 2 inches. It's get up and go, got up and went.
Yeah. Hey, I'm catching up with you after stopping and redoing my steed.
If you overtake me, I'll just zoom ahead.
All right.
Yeah, that's cheating. I don't care.
Boy, I see that they have, like, defaulted to the, my little war steed panel. Right smack in the middle of my screen, which is...
Oh, yeah, that's one of the first things I fix is...
Yeah, I usually do too, but...
All right, I'm going to go on ahead and meet everybody.
I don't want to run into trees while I'm doing it. Okay. So anyway, all right, so let's do a little review. So,
We looked at a gazebo.
So Dime was posting, and she just mentioned this as well in the Discord chat, that she found the other artichoke gazebo, which is up. It is near, as I was. I thought it was my. So my memory was serving me correctly in recalling that it was up near the. The giant that where you go to find that hobbit's pack up in the Brandy Hills, it's up near
Island
there.
That, you know, I went all over that place trying to figure out why that was there and what the quests were. There was nothing there.
Yeah. So it's,
so frustrating.
Yes. Yes. Now Tony Mead was noticing that the architecture in Trestle Bridge is very Tudor. Yes, it is,
yes,
Tony. And that's a really important point, actually. The sort of that Tudor architecture is very characteristic of the Breelands. So in the game, they have associated that particular architectural style with the human cultures that predate the Numenoreans. Mm-hmm. And that will become important before too long.
Looks a lot like England too, though, where you have like your Roman ruins next to your medieval castles, next to your Tudor pubs and your Victorian shop windows.
Yeah, and I really do like the sort of consistency that we get, through a lot
London
of that stuff.
London or Oxford or all those other places.
Yeah. Trying to get cute and cutting corners with my war steed here, which is always a little risky.
Oh, you're going to fall in the river, aren't you?
Yeah. I made it across the trestle span without falling, which was a victory. So now I'm going to see if I can...
The next one coming up is harder.
It is.
You don't hit the angle exactly right.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Hang on. I'm going to try to cheat here. I'm going to try to straighten it out in advance. I'm not going to follow the road. All right.
Even your keel, son. Even your keel.
I'm feeling confident. Here we go.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I totally got this. No problem. Okay. All right. Almost Esteldine now.
All right.
All right. Okay, now I'm going across fields and hopping fences. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was feeling a little, just a little intimidated by the English majors who remember things like iambic tetrameter and stuff like that, where the only one I can remember is pentameter for the Shakespeare deal.
Yeah.
But I'm sitting here, you know, being, you know, I studied music in high school and some of college, and I'm sitting there going, like, what instruments would you categorize, would you use to characterize each of those meters? And Tom always reminds me of the sort of squeaky fiddle going up and down and trilling all over the place. And
mm-hmm.
Just sort of being a dancing violin piece, while the whites just sound like a drum beat.
Yes, yes. It's an incantation, right? So it's supposed to have that kind of effect, that kind of
a chant. Yeah.
Yes, yes. It's much more chant-like, certainly much less dancey, obviously, than Tom Bombadil. Oh, hang on.
Yeah, it's more Philip Glass Coyani Scotsy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you just breezed past us, man.
I did, yeah. Sorry, I stopped right there. Sorry, I realized I was reaching for that. I normally have the, you know, like the skid to a stop command on the Warsteed.
Oh, yeah, no, I had the same problem. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking
about. I normally have that keyed on one on my my thing. So I was hitting one and I wasn't stopping and I couldn't figure out why.
Yeah, no, you were having that. I can't come back. I don't know how it works. Exactly. Goodbye, folks.
So I just dismounted. That took care of the problem. Okay, all right, here we are. So once again, we are here in Esteldine, which still does not have any iconography on its arches, which still kinds of bothers me. But the one theory that I have about this is really, it's not a theory, it's more of a joke, which is we were kind of joking about the fact that Esteldine is supposed to be like a secret fortress. But it's plainly visible from almost every angle. But maybe that was the nod towards secrecy, right? By not putting the Arnorian star in the stonework, they were keeping a low profile. You see,
well, this is just an ordinary colonnade. Nothing
exactly, right? Yeah, nothing to see here. No, this is not an Arthedain outpost or anything. You know, this is just a. Built by some, you know, there's nobody here but some totally generic and totally not Arthedainian folks.
They filed the serial numbers off.
right. You know, Tony's wondering, is it possible that it was built by the Dunedain after the fall of Arnor? It is possible, you know, that this was sort of designed to be a secret fortress after everything else was already a ruin. There are two things that kind of disincline me to that view, though. One is the fact that the ruins just look older. I mean, this does not look like... Well, okay. The fact that the architecture is less interesting in Esteldine could be, Tony, an argument in favor of what you were just saying, because, of course, the more recent, the newer would be the worse, right? You would expect the older architecture to be greater, bigger, fancier. So that could kind of work. But I don't know.
It also sort of shows this, like, fatalist humility. They're not calling on any kings to defend. They're not calling on any gods to save them. They're just, it's just there.
It's just there.
I mean,
there's
that one bit in the corner, the one bit on the lintel up there.
But yeah, which is buried.
Characteristic.
Right. I mean, like, it's been built over. it looks like, doesn't it?
Yeah, it almost looks like it's a different stone.
Yeah. Well, and anyway, certainly, I mean, the person who designed the arch above the door, which has the stars in it, yeah. Certainly didn't also design this other thing, or did so extremely incompetently. In fact, I think that whoever it was who designed this other, you know, sort of big old, like, portico lintel across the top there has a lot to answer for, because they're also keeping us from being able to see that image up there perfectly. And
it's like Roman reconstruction.
Exactly. It does.
It's definitely,
yeah.
Like, it's like they got rid of all the art of Greece and it's all functionality, and it's all badly done and more for
right
function than style, and they lost all their artisans.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you could tell they put that up there going, you know, forget the stars, we need archers up there.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 Yes, there does seem to be something sort of architecturally and artistically tone deaf about that blockage of the stars.
I really hope I'm not insulting some developer by saying this, by the way.
Well, no, because, I mean, see, like, notice over the crafting hall, right? There you get the original, which also has the Arnorian scepter at the top.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a crafting hall, and we don't have one bit of art around it.
Right. Right. Okay. All right, well, let's head up this way. We got over here before...
King's Fell. No, and I'm kicked off again. Why does this always happen?
Oh no, did you lose your link?
Yeah, I lost it again. I don't know why this always happens. It's like I'm fine and then just no particular reason. It's like I went through that whole thing with you guys with all the different layers and everybody porting in and out. And
huh.
No problem. It's just...
Crossing the boundary is what did it?
Yep. Yeah, crossing the boundary is what did it. Kicked me right off. Right. You go on ahead, I'll catch up. I always do.
Hang on a second, I was just thinking about something which we didn't think about before. And that
What's
is
that?
The name. We didn't talk
what,
about
Kingsfell?
That. Kingsfell, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, like they lost or something.
Well, it could mean one of two things.
Felt like a geographical location.
Well, exactly. It could be either one. Right, it could be, like the place where the kings fell, but it seems more likely to be the fell of the kings, right?
Yeah.
But when you look at it and you think about, you know, we've been all over this. We've been with a fairly fine tooth comb over the whole King's Fell region. We didn't look at every single farm, but apart from that, you know, we certainly looked at every ruin in the King's Fell region, and. The thing that interests me there is that why were these fells particularly the fells of the king? Why would they have been named that? Why was the king anywhere around there? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be much of a reason for that. I can't believe I just blew past the stable master in Estelding without even introducing myself, by the way.
I'll mark it on your to-do list.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's pretty uncharacteristic. Oh, it's because I was hurtling past on a worse deed, unable to stop.
Yeah.
That's why that happened.
You're doing your little Annie Oakley routine there.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. It's looking at the lay of the land, it almost looks like this is just land owned by the king that for the kings that no one really planned anything to do with. It's just one of those, hey, don't touch it, it's his kind of thing.
The
grassy area beyond it.
Right. Hang on a second. So someone is just asking what exactly a fell is, and I'm trying to remember the line. It's in a poem.
I can look that up real quick.
Now I don't want to screw up the line, but it's in the dwarf poem in The Hobbit. There it is. Yes, the dwarves of yore made mighty spells while hammers fell like ringing bells in places deep where dark things sleep in hollow halls beneath the fells.
Huh.
So a fell would be a like a and Nat Vilkas remembered it. A fell would be like a highland forest, essentially. Which is then especially odd because King's Fell is not a fell. In fact, it's kind of like a down, right? Or the Troll Fells north of Rivendell. Exactly. Uh-huh. Yes, yes. The Troll Fells, which you'll notice that a synonym for Troll Fell is essentially Ettenmoor, right?
Uh-huh.
Those words are kind of synonymous.
Oh, moor, yeah.
Yeah, so like a moor and moors and fells are sort of similar.
Moors usually imply sort of a marshland.
Or, yeah,
grassland is a moor.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly high and barren, Matt. Yes, exactly. Which again, none of it really seems to fit the like wide expanse of farmland, which is what is called King's Fell.
Oh, we got a sentry up there on the rock.
Yes. Where? Up high?
Up here.
Oh, up there, yeah. Hey, yeah. I never noticed that dude either.
Me neither. Oh, and there's another one on the other side.
Stands to reason. Yeah, there he is.
Well, maybe it's secret just because of their accuracy.
Yeah, but they have to pretty much shoot everybody from there because you come around the corner.
They got a good view.
Yeah, no, that's good.
It's nice to see rangers actually doing things for themselves.
That's right. It's very proactive of them.
Rather just less passive than they usually are.
Right. I guess, standing sentry duty is not exactly active now, is it? But
another one.
Yes. Now, this is the guy, of course. You get lots of quests from this dude.
Yeah. Melfinder.
Yeah, what is it? Yes, Melfindir. And there's that guy. We had a nice, clear day. Great view over here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do see some sort of swampy half-lakes over there.
Where?
Down just below. So the little lakes.
Oh yeah, those there are. Not quite a tarn, because it's down in the lowland. I like tarns.
It's like a mud puddle from here.
Yeah, from here. Of course, straight in front of us there in the pass in the mountains
rather imposing.
pretty impressive. Boy, I remember the first day I saw that when I was with Grifflet. I think I must have... Okay, no. The reason I never noticed it before was because I had my graphics low when I was, actually doing the completionist North Downs with my lore master. My graphics were fairly low, so I couldn't see it from here. And I had just never looked up and noticed it when I was nearby, because I just never did. But it's huge. That's, of course, the gate to Angmar.
Looks like the Cumberland Gap, Virginia.
Yeah, and we'll get closer to there and see. But just look at the walls of mountains with that one sharp cleft in it there.
Is this a boxed-in valley here?
A
box canyon or something?
Well, sort of. I mean,
I never know whether it's topographically accurate or whether the developers are doing that to keep the land separate.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, six of one, half a dozen of another, but...
Probably.
Yeah. Back to King's Fell. Matt is suggesting that it could be land held by the king, you know, rather than held by a vassal, like, you know, designated as the king's land. And it's true. It's close to Fornos, but it's not that close to Fornos.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure.
We're still in Rudaur's territory, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, Rudaur started back here where I still have... I see we haven't been on this server since we were at Mina's Run, because I see I still have quest rings out there in Mina's Run. so right where my quest rings are on my map is where we saw the beginning of the Rudauran ruins. And then they stretch certainly all north of the road and around where the dwarves were. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we had the one gazebo by the artichoke people, who I can't help but notice that the artichoke gazebo is like right next to the word King's Fell on the map. So,
Yeah. Which king? That's the question.
Yeah, I suppose it is, isn't it? Could conceivably be the king of Rudauer. But you'd think that they wouldn't keep calling it that at this point.
I don't see him as an artichoke kind of guy either.
Yeah, probably not.
Even pre his pine tree and scepter interest.
What's that over there, to the southeast?
That is an orc and goblin army amassing itself. Remember the rope bridge that we can go on when we just go past Trestle Bridge?
Yes,
it's all connected.
Right, it connects down in there, and I know there's the big camp down there. But is that a ruin sticking up above the rocks over up there?
Yeah, it sure looks like a ruin. I don't know if we can get to it, but it's there.
And we'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, let's go see.
Okay. Though first, I think we... Tempting though it is to just skip it, I think we shouldn't skip it.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
The which?
Around to the left here.
Refresh my memory.
These dudes.
Oh, those guys.
Yeah, the Earthkin.
Yeah.
So these guys. These guys are not the greatest lore moment in Lotro, but just kind of accepting them here. I'm always tempted to make exceptions for the Earthkin. But what are they? Giants, right? I mean, obviously, they're giants. Sort of lesser giants, but they're giants. And we come across this village and find that these are peaceful giants, and there are, like, non-peaceful giants also here.
Scratching their butts.
Yeah. Which is significant, right? Because, I mean, there's a certain subset of NPCs in Lotro which will stand around and scratch their butts, right? Like, they tend to be, like... Orcs, barbarians, like...
Trolls.
Yeah. You won't generally see that happening in, say, Rivendell.
or Lothlorien.
Right, exactly. So... I think, first of all, you know, one thing that I would say about the Earthkin is that I think it's... The impulse is interesting... Right, the impulse to add giants. We get giants in the mountains, right? Like the giants of the Misty Mountains. Uh-huh. And those are at least semi-canonical, right?
Yeah.
Because we've got stone giants in the mountains, right? You know, they're like sort of presumably the same giants that were chucking rocks around Thorin and company in The Hobbit.
In the Thunder Battle.
Exactly. However, you know, one of the most interesting things, and it was something that I was really enjoying watching when we were talking about the Treason of Isengard in the last Mythgard Academy class, is that I mean, first of all, the objective question, why are there no giants in Middle-earth in the Lord of the Rings? Like, why are there no giants in the Lord of the Rings world? There's never any reference to it, like any serious reference to a giant.
Yeah.
Why? Like, why not? It seems actually, when you think about it, a really peculiar kind of omission, right?
Yeah.
I mean, giants
just like
are
fairies, just like how we mentioned, one of the hobbits having a fairy wife back then. He just sort of, I don't know, he seemed to sort of, you almost feel like Tolkien just sort of wanted to leave the Victorian beasties back in the Victorian era and just not bring it back over here.
Sure, but like giants, though, I mean, giants are really standard folklore creatures, you know? I mean,
didn't he make reference that giants are one of the few mythologies, like, really crucial to England or something like that?
Giants are very...
Because, you have, like, Gog and Magog and...
not to mention the
Bully Boys.
The real... I had to read a lot of Inklings and 19th century literature before I came to appreciate the role of Jack the Giant Killer in, like, 19th and early 20th century English culture. I mean, like, it's like everybody's favorite, you know, fairy tale. Jack the Giant Killer is very iconic in, you know, 19th and early 20th century English culture. That becomes really clear by the references to it and the kind of references to it.
Yeah, same as Roald Dahl.
Yeah. So anyway, point is, there's no real a priori reason why there shouldn't be giants in Middle Earth. In fact, if anything, I find it surprising that there aren't giants. Giants, for instance, are far more staple features of folklore and fairy tale traditions than dragons are, frankly.
Yeah.
There are way more giant stories than there are dragon stories.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
But yet we get dragons in Middle-earth and we don't get giants. Or I mean, I know they're in The Hobbit, and yes, Brick Tales, there is that, of course, the reference of Gandalf wanting to find a more or less decent giant to block up the goblins tunnel.
Yes.
But that, again, that's in The Hobbit. He makes the what is clearly the conscious choice to write giants out of the Lord of the Rings. We don't get the giants anymore. You know, remember the difference between the stone giants lobbing rocks and Karathras, right? The spirit of the mountain with whom they interact there in the Fellowship of the Ring.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that was really cool in The Treason of Isengard is that that impulse to write giants out, like the cutting of giants out of Middle-earth lore, doesn't happen right away, right? Exactly, as Brandon was saying, as was recalling from our discussions in The Treason of Isengard, Treebeard was originally a giant, like not an ant, but just a giant, like a proper giant. And he was a proper giant for a while through several drafts of the story. So giants don't truly get removed from the Lord of the Rings world until Treebeard becomes an ent, you know, until he becomes a tree guy.
Yeah.
A tree man instead of a tree man, which is what he calls giants at first. But anyhow, which of course originally just means men as tall as trees. Anyhow, so all this is as much as to say, I think that the Earthkin are sort of defensible from a, like, sort of curiosity standpoint. Like, hey, let's put a race of random giants who are kind of mysteriously benevolent and generally peaceable, but not always.
They seem to have their own agenda.
Yeah, exactly. I know that a lot of people object to the Earthkin because there's really no kind of warrant for them at all in the text. It's one of the few places where, and there are lots of places, of course, where the Lotro world expands on very, very slight references, right? Where there'll be a hint or an implication, which will then be fleshed out into a story within Lotro. And this is one of the very few examples of a place where something is just imported, in whole cloth, and there's no kind of justification, no gesture at justification for them. They're just kind of tossed in there.
Yeah, and just such radical features that they've been given in the giant horns.
The giant horns, which I, by the way, interacted with them numerous times before I realized they were not actually their own horns. I thought they were horned.
Oh, they're orc horns.
Yeah, well, I finally realized
that. Why don't you say that? I get it immediately.
Yeah. So, like, but, like, the first time I met them, it wasn't here. The first time I met them was in the Lone Lands.
Yeah, Lone Lands,
you know,
yeah,
the ones there.
That one bit on the hill. And yeah, it looks like they have horns coming out of their shoulders.
I was like, why do they have these ridiculous horns sticking out of their shoulders? And then I realized that they're, of course, detachable horns. They're the best detachable party horns.
So it looked like it'd knock you way off balance.
Yeah, I mean, it's still, don't get me wrong, it still is sort of absurd, but
it's a little goofy.
It is a little bit goofy. It really wasn't until I actually came here, the whole time I interacted with the ones in the Lone Lands, I thought they were growing those horns. I think it was because it was so goofy, I couldn't imagine anyone wearing those horns electively, you know. But then when I came here and I did the quest where I had to carry the giant oryx skull back from the other camp across the way, that I was like, hey, look, I look just like those Earthkin guys.
They're a bit jarring, too. I mean, their faces don't look benevolent at all. They got these needle-fine teeth.
Yes.
They got these goat eyes with the sideways pupils.
Yes. And they have pointy ears.
Yeah.
Like elves.
Or goblins. They almost look like goblin ears.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
And this gorgeous emo purple hair.
Yeah.
But yeah, they almost look like fish-like, or sort of fish cats.
These guys especially. This guy over here at least is having a good time.
Yeah, he's the only one who looks like it. But no, even then, he's just got his head is lolling, his eyes
That's
are
true.
Just sort of staring.
And his face looks just kind of dead, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got rhythm, but yeah, it's...
At what cost?
At what cost? Yeah. So they're alien and they're kind of weird. I mean, so again, I can understand the impulse to say, hey, let's like bring in this other culture, and you know, make them kind of like complex and interesting. Complex in the sense that, like, you know, some of them are peaceful and they have these, you know, internal clan issues, and there's the other rebellious clan which is all violent and bloodthirsty. And
do we join with Angmar or not?
Yeah, exactly. They're being recruited by Angmar. And, you know, so the storylines I don't really object to.
Uh-huh. But, yeah, the design is very more, role-playing game kind of
thing. Yeah, but like I say, the thing that kind of makes them jarring is that there are so few examples of them doing this kind of thing in game. Of just, like, we're just going to flat make up something wholly unprecedented with no warrant of any kind in the text.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Like, what's interesting to me about it is that most of the time in most adaptations, like, people wouldn't even apologize for that. It's to me, it's sort of like a testimony to the adherence to the books that the game shows, that the Earthkin or the Earthkin should seem so weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of amazing that they don't do that more than they do. But
yeah, and you can tell this is an early attempt to expand the lore, and they went in different directions for other parts of it.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard for me not to be influenced by, you know, I've heard Chris Pearson tell the story. Really, more importantly, whenever I think of the Earthkin, I can't help but think of the look on Chris Pearson's face when he talks about the Earthkin.
Yeah, I remember that, actually.
Chris Pearson, of course, one of the primary developers, the senior lore hound, gives his job description. And he is an unfriend to the Earthkin.
I think he said the Earthkin is what spawned him to start asking his developers every time, the writing team especially, whenever time they were going to deviate from the book, he'd throw the quote at them, "What would zombie Tolkien's?"
Exactly, right, yeah, that's the yes.
And I made them that sign for it.
yes, when you drew zombie Tolkien for him, that's right.
Yes, I did. He's going, "Lore."
Okay, so I'm looking around for that that ruin to the south, but
I think it's straight ahead, actually, this way.
Straight ahead, which way?
This way. I think I see it. It's nestled in that one mountain over there. Yep, I see it.
Aha! Yeah, let's go check that out. Sorry, we are where am I? Where are we right now? We're approaching the road.
Yeah, we're in the road.
Yeah, the road is just up here, yeah.
Yeah. I'll stop at the road so you guys can catch up. Where you at? Where did you guys all go? Oh, there you are.
All right.
Okay, so you can see a little bit of it here, but I think we need to get a closer look, honestly. It's
right. Kind of makes you wonder, is this road an old road? I see no evidence of paving. I mean, there are no paving stones, even occasionally.
Yeah, it might just be something cut into something.
These are clearly modern in the sense of being Angmarim.
Yeah. Oh, so was that a building, or is that just a rock face over there?
Huh. I thought it was a building, too, but maybe it's just a rock face.
Maybe they tucked a building in there somewhere, and then maybe it's stuck in the code somewhere, like an invisible chicken.
Right, here's one of the bad giants, who looks exactly like the good giants.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's going for someone.
Alright.
That's fun.
Huh. That is just a rock face.
Huh. Yeah, it didn't look like that from back there.
No, it sure didn't. Here I thought it was a ruin.
Yeah.
Are there
a weird looking ruin? Or a rock. Yes, weird looking rock.
We're heading down into a fairly significant orc camp down here. But I don't think, if I recall correctly, there aren't any ruins around there in the orc camp.
Nope, I don't know. It's all just rocks and rivets. Some machine-made, some natural.
Hmm. You know what this banner looks like? It's an orc banner, obviously, but
looks a bit like that Iron Crown and Rudar's.
Exactly, doesn't it? It looks kind of like Rudar's trees, except they're dead. Like, these are not. This is obviously not the Rudaran symbol. This is an orc symbol. But it's interesting.
I'm pretty sure that's the Iron Crown there.
yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting how similar that is.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I'm sure it's not a coincidence either. These are probably Angmar orc.
Yeah. No, they are. But it's interesting how similar it is to the Rudaran symbol.
Well, I remember we had the theory. We were thinking maybe that he was, you know, Rudar was sort of subtly being influenced by Angmar.
Exactly.
In his
at first,
design of
and
a logo.
His design of a logo, exactly. Yeah, no, I think we got these sort of Angmarim posts here, but then everything else I think is just tents and trees.
Tents and war machines.
Yeah, tents. I don't think we get any stone down in here.
Machines are pretty fascinating, actually.
Yes. Yeah. So this is not the case of them investing some ancient, you know, and some ruins, some old Rudauran or
Which we have seen before. We've seen that in the Lone
Definitely. Definitely.
This place was obviously just sort of... It's barren. You wonder if it was this barren before they took over.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, as you see, many of the trees have been felled, like over here, right? Mm-hmm.
These are sick trees, too. Look at them. They're not... This is what I have. I have a pine tree on my property. It needs to go. Kind of looks like this.
Yes, this, you're right. This is not a well tree right here. Yeah. And then the one that is green is cut down.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Well, that's the one they want to build their machines with. They can't build machines with the rotten logs. They have to build it with the green logs.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't want to go... I'm tempted, but I don't want to go traipsing through the whole orc camp.
Yeah, I think that'd be a little hard on some of our squishies.
It would be, yeah, exactly. But anyway, it's also getting fairly late.
Oh, yeah, so it's past midnight.
It is past midnight. So the next time we come up to the North Downs, I want to head up to the camps up by the Angmarin border. Mm-hmm. But I believe that next time we're going to... we'll do the Barrow Downs for at least probably two sessions, and then we'll come back and we'll head up to the northern sort of the northeast sections up there and up towards Angmar there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for joining me on the field trip and for tonight for class. I know I was back last week, but still, I still feel like this week I'm kind of getting back into my normal schedule and routine, so it's nice to be kind of getting back things together here. But
yeah, no, I have a turkey break hangover right now just from having to do nothing and sleeping when I want to. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Who needs that?
That's right. All right, so thanks everybody, and don't forget Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy tomorrow night, 10 p.m. And then we'll be back, of course, on Tuesday. I think, if I'm recalling correctly, I believe we have SimFilm this week as well. So SimFilm is back on Friday, and I'll be back on my Griffith stream and everything. So it's business as usual back again this week, which is great. So, but thanks everybody for joining me, and I'll see you guys around soon.
All right.
All right. Bye now.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for joining me on this epic exploration of The Lord of the Rings and of Standing Stone's video adaptation of Tolkien's story. If you are having even half the fun I'm having on this journey, I hope you will consider supporting the project by donating at signumuniversity.org/fund.